Blog Talk Radio.
It's 8:52 here in New York. I'm Brian Gumbel. We understand that there has been a plane crash on the southern tip of Manhattan. You're looking at the World Trade Center. We understand that a plane has crashed into the World Trade Center. We don't know anything more than that. We don't know if it was a commercial aircraft. We don't know if it was a private aircraft. We have no idea how many were on board or what the extent of the injuries are right now. We have, I understand, an eyewitness on the phone right now. Sir, good morning. This is Bryant Gumbel. Could you give us your name?
Yeah, my name is Stuart.
Stuart, where are you right now?
I'm working at a restaurant in Soho.
All right, so tell us what you saw, if you would.
I was waiting at a table, and I literally saw it seemed to be like a small plane. I just heard a couple noises. It looked like it, like, bounced off the building, and then I just saw a huge, like, ball of fire on top. And then the smoke seemed to simmer down, and it just stung. You know, a lot of smoke was coming out, and that's pretty much the extent of what I saw.
Can you tell us about the scene down there right now?
Right now, people are just on the street looking at the building. The building, it was just a lot of smoke. It's not too crazy down where I am.
How far away from the World Trade Center specifically are you?
I'm actually on Thompson Street North. I'm not too far.
It's 8:54 right now, Stuart. Can you tell me when this happened exactly?
I would have to say about 10 minutes ago.
Were you looking up as the plane approached the building, or did it only catch your attention after it crashed into the World Trade Center?
I heard a crashing sound, but I looked up quick enough to actually see something go into the building, but everything happened so fast I wasn't quite sure what I was looking at.
So there's no way you can know whether or not the plane seemed to be in trouble before it crashed into the building.
Oh, no, I couldn't tell.
It's hard for us to tell from the picture we're seeing just how far down from the top that plane crashed. Have you any better eyesight to it from your vantage point?
Not really. All I know is it definitely wasn't the top of the building, because that seems to be intact from what I saw.
Obviously, the timing of this is important. It comes before 9 o'clock. Perhaps, and we say that in hopeful fashion, perhaps not everybody was at work, because if that building was in fact crowded with workers, we're looking at probably some casualties and injuries of considerable proportions. But right now there's no way of telling that. We're on the line with another eyewitness. Sir, this is Bryant Gumbel in New York.
Oh, how you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. You're Wendell?
Yes, I am.
Wendell, can you give me your last name?
Klein.
Wendell Klein. Tell me where you are, if you would.
Well, right now I'm back in the hotel. I'm in the hotel offices here, the front office.
You're in the... Okay, where were you when
I was standing right in front of the hotel. I'm the doorman there. And...
The hotel. Which hotel?
Marriott World Trade Center.
Right across from the World Trade Center.
It's actually right in between them.
Right in between the World Trade Center.
Yes.
Okay, so you were standing outside, and tell us what you saw and what you heard.
Well, what I heard first, an explosion, and I just figured that it was a plane passing by. Then all of a sudden, stuff just started falling, like bricks and paper and everything. And so I just kind of like ran like inside to get away from the falling debris and glass and so forth. Then... after, like, everything stopped, because it, like, was falling in the street and the cars were crashing into each other. And then when it kind of stopped, I heard a guy screaming. And when I looked over, there was this guy that was on fire. So I kind of, like, ran over, and I tried to, like, put the fire out on him. And he was like, screaming. And I just told him to roll, and he said he can't. And then another guy came over with his bag and kind of, like, put the flames out on him. So right now, he's being taken care of. I just had everyone call the ambulance and stuff so it can help him out.
He caught fire as a result of the falling debris?
Yeah.
How much debris, can you give us an idea of how much came crashing to the ground?
It's just a lot. Bricks, a lot of bricks, a lot of glass. I'm like, enough to like damage cars on the street, make cars swerve into each other, that kind of thing.
I hear alarms going off down there. What's happening?
That's our hotel alarm, and basically... I guess that went off automatically. They've evacuated everyone in the hotel. They evacuated all employees.
They have evacuated the hotel?
Yes.
Immediately?
Yes.
Are you hearing anything, Wendell, about what kind of a plane it was
or
how many were on board?
No.
All right. Mr. Klein, thank you very much, sir. I understand Teresa Renault is with us right now. Ms. Renault, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
This is Bryant Gumbel. I'm down on 59th and 5th. Where are you?
I am in Chelsea, and we are at 8th and 16th. We are the tallest building in the area, and my window faces south, so it looks directly onto the World Trade Center. And I would say, you know, approximately 10 minutes ago, there was a major explosion from probably, it looks like about the 80th floor. It looks like it's affected probably 4 to 8 floors. Major flames are coming out of the north side and also the east side of the building, yes. And it was very loud explosion followed by flames, and it looks like the building is still on fire on the inside.
Which building are we talking about, the one that's westernmost?
Yes, sir.
Did you hear the explosion from your position?
Yes, we did. As a matter of fact, we heard it, and because I was just like standing there pretty much looking out the window, I didn't see what caused it or if there was an impact.
So you have no idea right now?
Oh, there's another one. Another plane just hit. Right? Oh, my God. Another plane has just hit. It hit another building. Flew right into the middle of it. Explosion. My God, it's right in the middle of the building.
This one into the east tower.
Yes. Yes. Right in the middle of the building. And right now, that was definitely looked like it was on purpose.
You saw a plane?
Yes, I just saw a plane go into the building.
Why do you say that was definitely on purpose?
Because it just flew straight into it. It looks like it's about, 15 floors lower than the first building, and there's now flames coming out of that building as well. They're both completely on fire.
Now, Teresa, hang on with us 1 second. We're going to re-rack the tape. of when we were talking to you to see if we can tell.
Okay.
We can't see anything. We can't see a second plane in the picture. There we see the explosion.
Hey, everybody. James Bostic there. That was Bryant Gumbel, September 11th, 2001. As it happened, and like so many Americans, we all sat stunned, shocked, transfixed. It was a beautiful day 17 years ago here in West Virginia. Wasn't a cloud in sight. An azure blue sky. I just started a new job a couple of weeks before that, maybe even a week. Hadn't been there very long. I was teaching massage therapy at a school in town. I'd gone to the school and anyway, wound up teaching there shortly after I got my certification. And that particular day, I remember we had done a little bit of anatomy lecture, and I had paired the students up to go off and work on the techniques we had been studying for that particular week. And I got a phone call from my dad, who's retired, lived in Florida at that time, said that an airplane had flown into one of the World Trade Towers. Well, at the time, like everyone else, I thought, you know, the small single-engine plane, it was an accident, it was a mishap. Something happened to a small private plane, and it flew into the towers. So I got one of the stereo systems that we had up in the rooms there and got it on a radio station, a CBS affiliate. And Dan Rather. Now, in those days, 2001, Dan Rather was very much a TV guy. He was CBS News anchor. He was the evening anchorman. And he was given the commentary. Well, this told me that this was something more significant than simply a small plane. And as I'm listening to Rather describe what he is seeing and the type of damage that they're getting reports on, it was obvious this was not a small plane. And then as I'm listening to that report, we get news of the second jetliner impacting on the second building. The average age of Americans right now, the average age of people in this country is about 37, 38 years old. And a lot of people weren't even alive back in this day. This was the Pearl Harbor of our generation. I'll never forget that day. And from that moment on, we had the radio on. We didn't worry about class anymore. I think everybody, it was just one of those seminal moments, one of those transfixing moments, the Kennedy assassination, Pearl Harbor, the death of Franklin Roosevelt, moments that people, you know, just these the moon landing, these moments where people just are transfixed at that time, in that moment, and you remember what you were doing. You never forget what you were doing. People never forgot what they were doing when they found out about Kennedy being shot. Folks remembered, you know, exactly what they were doing when they got the news that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had died. And what's happened to that memory in those days? September 11th, 2001. New York, along with Washington, D.C., because, you know, we also heard about what had happened with the Pentagon and the plane that was taken over by the passengers and prevented from doing any more damage by crashing that field in Pennsylvania. We were struck by this terrorist attack. The impact of this terrorist attack on Washington, D.C. and the World Trade Centers shook the world. Mainstream European commentators attributed the terrorist attacks to legitimate Muslim grievances against America, and then they turned and breezily dismissed any suggestions that Europe could be hit as well. Sweeping aside Osama bin Laden's claims, President Bush told us the attacks had nothing to do with Islam, which he called a religion of peace. He then sent armed forces to liberate Afghanistan and Iraq on the premise that the people of those countries, if allowed to vote in democratic elections, would choose a democratic path. It all turned out to be spectacularly wrong. The European savants were shown up by the horrific attacks in Madrid and Beslan and London and elsewhere, and their perpetrators put the lie to the religion of peace rhetoric, repeatedly announcing that they were committing jihad, a core Islamic concept. Some people in the West understood, but the West's cultural elite turned away. And Western leaders, while sending young men to fight abroad, left the gates wide open at home. In Western Europe, this recklessness had an impact well beyond terrorism. Sharia enclaves, violent crime, a financial burden that has forced welfare states to cut back on education, health care, and elder care, while other immigrant groups integrated into European host cultures. Muslims demanded, with increasing success, that those cultures adapt to Islam. In recent years, German New Year's Eve celebrations have become rape fests, and once trendy, swanky French boulevards have been taken over by migrant tent cities. In Britain, defenders of jihad get embraced by London mayors or knighted by the Queen, while critics of Islam get thrown into prison or turned away at the border. Yet politicians and the media on both sides of the Atlantic keep insisting that Islam enriches Western society. And school children continue to be taught that diversity is our strength. Folks, 9/11 was the most dramatic of warning shots. Every new terrorist is only a reminder. We're under siege. Yet countless Westerners still turn away. In 17 years since 9/11, that spirit. September 11, 2001 demonstrated on multiple levels, a lot of different things, but it demonstrated the shock, obviously, the horror, the rage, but more importantly, the unashamed patriotism and moral clarity. All those things that happened that day were yet unclouded by the poisonous cynicism of moral relativism and the multicultural shilly-shallying give and take that would lead to so much national division and self-doubt in the years to come. That day, that spirit of September 11, 2001, basically has been succeeded by 17 years, 17 years of moral chaos, 17 years of duplicity, of flim-flam, of double-dealing, of humbug, 17 years of timorousness, incompetence, and impotence. And do you know why? Why? Because we've been lied to about our enemies. George W. Bush massaged the Muslim world with insipid rhetoric about our shared heritage of people as people of faith. Barack Obama spun outrageous fantasies about Islam, transforming 14 centuries of primitive brutality into a shining, glittering parade of moral, cultural, intellectual, and spiritual triumphs. 9/11, 2001 was a day of heroes and a day of villains. A day of stark contrasts between good and evil. And look at how quickly the politicians and the journalists and others in positions of authority managed to make a muddle of it all. Instead of witnessing a democratization of the Middle East, we experienced a steady Islamization of the West. Instead of seeing freedom bloom in the Islamic world, we saw a rise in Western censorship and self-censorship on the subject of Islam. Well, at least that part's changed. Not as much as we might hope, but certainly more than one might have expected after all those years of George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Finally, in Donald Trump. I don't care whether you like him, I don't care whether you don't, doesn't matter. finally, in Donald Trump, we have a president and we have a top dog in the free world who gets it. He understands the very real existential threat that fundamentalist Islam presents to us. Yes, he could go further, both in words and actions on Islam, but he's already gone. Donald Trump has already gone light years beyond his predecessors. He's gone far enough to outrage the sympathizers everywhere. And he's gone far enough so that Americans who get it know beyond a shadow of a doubt that he gets it and that he's on our side and that we're behind him. As Donald Trump's rock star reception in Warsaw, Poland last year reflected, most Eastern Europeans who, unlike the editorial board of the New York Times, recognize a champion of freedom and totalitarian ideology when they see him, they're behind him too. And they're giving the finger to the European leaders who demand that they let in a Trojan horse in the form of unchecked Islamic Muslim immigration. Now, meanwhile, in Western Europe, where all the hoi polloi's hate Trump as much as do their stateside counterparts, millions of people, including those in Germany and France and elsewhere, who are finally rising up in boisterous public protests against their own despised leader. But these guys see Trump as a long-awaited truth teller when it comes to this issue, a sign of hope. His enemies call him a fascist. On the contrary, he's the first president since 9/11 who genuinely seems to grasp the idea that Islam is fascism. He's as far from denial and fatalism as it is possible to be on this issue. He talks sense, he talks tough, and he takes action that is in America's interests. He's crushed ISIS. He's shown the Islamic State of, heads of state who's boss. And against the resistance of both major party establishments and the legislative and judicial branches of the U.S. government, he's done his best to pull in the welcome mat. At this point, all his counterparts in Europe seem to be able to do is repeat empty multiculturalist slogans and manage a transition to the unimaginable. Trump, on the other hand, here in the United States, is with us, manning the barricades. Yes, yes, the jury's still out, but big things are happening. Islam is pushing Western Europe to the brink of either ruin or revolt. And 17 years after 9/11, we have reason to hope that America is finally headed in the right direction. Winston Churchill once said that the moderate Muslim — how can you tell the difference? Basically, he was talking about the difference between the moderate Muslim and the radical Muslim. And Churchill said that the moderate Muslim is the one who holds you down while the radical Muslim cuts off your head. There are a number of people who will say, well, we're not at war with Islam, granted. But Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, Islam sure in hell is at war with us. I guess you can call it a religion. It's something I think more, I think it's something considerably more sinister than a cult, because it's an all-encompassing way of life. Iran is a classic example, where you have this Sharia theocracy. It's a means of governance. It's a means of worship. It's a means of criminal justice. It's a means of foreign policy. It's a means of economics. It injects itself into every single solitary aspect of the Muslim's life, and it takes priority over everything. It is a religion that looks askance at pedophilia. It is not interested in Western criticisms of pedophilia, or pederasty for that matter. It is a religion that engages in genital, female genital mutilation. It engages in the rape of girls and boys and women. It is a system that engages in torture. Of rape, of theft, of destruction. I do not think it to be anything good, positive, or beneficial towards humanity in any way. It is a doctrine of oppression. It is a doctrine of subjugation. It is a doctrine of violence, of terror. We look at what happens. We look at what happens when we see Muslims doing these things. Raping boys and girls. Raping women. Killing Jews. Killing Americans. Killing Christians. Cutting their heads off. Putting them in cages and then lowering them into swimming pools and filming them drowning. Putting them in cages and immolating them. Setting them on fire and filming it. Cutting heads off. Slitting throats. Burying women up to their heads in sand and then stoning them to death. All these things we see and we go, my God, how barbaric. These are bad Muslims. Well, the truth of the matter is, these are good Muslims. You know why they're good Muslims? Because they are doing those things which the Quran commands them to do. The Quran tells them it's okay to treat children the way they do, to abuse women and children, to rape, to torture, to suppress them. That it's okay to lie to Christians and Jews. It's okay to trade in deceit and deception. That's what a good Muslim does. Now, that's not what we see as a good Muslim. We see a good Muslim as the kind, tolerant, understanding, accepting. But there's no such thing, man. There's just no such thing. And they, oh, yeah, there is. They can act that way. Sure, they can. Have you ever heard of the concept, the doctrine of taqiyya? And that's what I'm talking about when I talk about it's okay to lie to the unbeliever, to the infidel. Muslims don't go to hell for lying. It's okay to lie. They can't lie to one another, but they can lie to Christians and Jews and Buddhists and Sikhs and atheists all day long. They can deceive you. They can cheat you. The Quran says it's okay. When these guys do these videos of decapitations and cutting people's heads off, that's what the Quran tells them to do. Cut the infidel's head off. Cut the unbeliever's head off. So all those things that they do that we say, God, that's terrible. Those are bad Muslims. They're not bad Muslims. They're fundamental. Those are the mainstream Muslims. Those are the guys that are keeping the faith. In their eyes, the Muslims that we see as good Muslims, the moderate Muslims, those are the bad Muslims because they are not doing that which the Quran commands them to do. I really didn't mean to take up all this time concerning this, but, you know, sometimes it goes that way. We will be back. We're down to the bottom of the hour, so I'm going to scroll through here and find, as we do every Tuesday and Thursday, you would think by now, after 4 years, I think me and Mark have been doing this show for like 3 years. I'm coming up on 4 years. I would go ahead and have all that stuff queued up. But you know what? I don't. And I don't know what else to say about it. So that's what we're going to. So I'm just going to roll through here, and I'm going to find something to listen to. And we will be back with more on Conservative Perspective right after this. We'll be right back. Yowza. Okay, James Bostic here back with the Conservative's Perspective here on the Patriot Nation. No, this way, God bless. What is it? If it's Tuesday, then this must be blog. Then I have to be James Bostic, but this must be Blog Talk Radio. So we're doing the live version here, and we do that Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, until it changes, until the time changes, and it'll be 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. We do have a recorded version that goes out on the Patriot Nation Holy Hannah. Why don't you just say the damn sentence, man? Okay. James Bostic here with a Conservative's Perspective. We do this live Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Until the time changes, then it'll be 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We have a recorded version of this that goes out on the Talk America Radio Network, talkamericaradio.org. You go there, they have two different audio streaming channels, the Liberty and Justice Stream, ACP, heard at various times throughout the day and week on either one of those. In 1938, storm clouds were gathering in Europe as well as in the Far East. Nazi Germany had begun its expansionist policies by annexing Poland, Czechoslovakia, the Sudetenland, Albania, and they were moving further east, ultimately with the goal of enslaving Russia. And what they were going to do, the plan was, the Nazis were going to come into these areas. They were going to exterminate the populations already living there beyond what they may need for slave labor. And then Germans were going to move into these places. And it was going to be part of the new Deutschland, the Thousand-Year Reich. Not much different in the Far East. Japan's imperialist expansionist tendencies had run havoc. China, Korea, Vietnam, Thailand, Burma. They had designs on India, any number of islands throughout the Pacific, the Philippines. And this was all to be part of the Japanese Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. So when America looked towards the Atlantic, we saw the threat of war from Nazi Germany. When we looked to the west in the Pacific, we knew that Japan had no less intention than subjugating all of the Pacific Ocean, Hawaii, perhaps even the west coast of the United States. There were people who saw these things happening, and they understood very clearly that war was coming. It would start in Europe. It would start in Asia. But eventually, those flames would touch the shores of the United States. There was a larger faction, however, who embraced a very strong isolationist position. We've got the Atlantic Ocean to protect us and to use as a buffer between the United States and Europe. We have the vast Pacific Ocean that we can use likewise against the Empire of Japan. But the isolationist policy was one simply of whistling past the graveyard. Even the people who were advocating an isolationist policy knew and understood very clearly that once war was thrust upon us, it would be global and we would have no chance, we would have no choice but to immerse ourselves totally in it. Why am I talking about 1938? Well, there's a couple of reasons. I think on a number of levels, war is coming to us again. When I was younger, I always thought that that ultimate throwdown between good and evil would be the forces of the free world against those of communism, of tyranny. I don't think that's going to be the case anymore. I think at some point we're going to have it out with Muslims. I wish it weren't the case. But just as the Japanese and the Germans were clearly the aggressors in the events leading up to the Second World War, I feel that it is the fundamentalist Muslim who is the aggressor here and acting in such a manner as to precipitate this war. And it's going to be a terrible one. No one's going to be safe from it. It's going to touch everywhere. Some places it's going to touch heavily, but it's going to touch. And in 1938, there, as I said, were people in America who understood this. We were just finally starting to crawl out from underneath the terrible economic depression that Franklin Roosevelt's policies had put us in. He was a Democrat, by the way. Everybody says all this great stuff about welfare and Social Security and the New Deal and National Recovery Act. These things probably prolonged the Depression by about 8 years. Neither here nor there. This is what I want to play for you. Irving Berlin, in 1938, wrote a song especially for Kate Smith. Who was Kate Smith? Well, Kate Smith was this unbelievably big, good-looking woman who had a tremendous voice. She was about 5'10", 200 pounds. She was a statuesque babe. Okay, she was holding. And one of the things that she was holding within that body was this tremendous, beautiful voice. Play for You is the very first time Kate Smith sung this song that was written for her by the legendary Irving Berlin. This is her signature tune. Now, you may not know who Kate Smith is, but you'll know this song. And I think we just need to listen to it. And we need to remember who we are, where we came from.
It's going to be my great, very great privilege to sing for you a song that's never been sung before by anybody. One that was written especially for me by one of the greatest composers in the music field today. It's something more than a song. I feel it's one of the most beautiful compositions that was ever written. A song that will never die. The author, Mr. Irving Berlin, the title, God Bless America. While the storm clouds gather far across the sea, let us swear allegiance to our land that's free. Let us all be grateful. We're far.
Now, I don't care who you are. That will bring a tear to a glass eye.
Well, it's all great, James, but, you know, it's 1938. That was already some years ago. What does that have to do with today?
Well, there are some similarities between 2019 and 1938. We face today, right here, as you and I are talking about this kind of stuff, a threat no less dangerous, no less existential in its presence, no less intractable, no less fanatical, no less committed, no less extreme than what we saw with the damn Nazis. I hate those guys. And whenever someone on the other side, one of those leftists, those Antifa types, those Black Lives Matters, those Occupy Wall Street types, those guys that think it's cool for a dude to go ahead and pee in a lady's bathroom when there are little girls in it, all those people who call me Nazi and people like me Nazis, oh, son, are you ever walking on the fighting side of me? But this thing that we face today, fundamental Islamism, that's what I'm talking about. And it's different now, see? In those days, we had nation states. Who's the bad actor? Well, it's Nazi Germany. It's fascist Italy. It's Imperial Japan. There were nation states. There were geographic centers that we knew. That's where these people come from. Where are the Nazis coming from? Nazi Germany. Right, yeah. So we got to go. We got to go get them. Same thing with Japan. Same thing with Italy. In all three cases, the doctrine itself of tyranny is fundamentally the same. Now it's a little bit different because the geographic border component of it isn't so much nowadays. The people, the Muslims, the fundamentalist Muslims, they're not radical, okay? Radical means that it's some kind of extreme departure from the norm. No, 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 no. What these guys are doing is the norm. The guys that are cutting heads off, that are raping boys and girls, that are raping women, that are massacring people, that are destroying things, That's the fundamental. That's what we do. Fundamentally, this is what we do. That's why we call them fundamentalists, because these are their fundamentals. Pedophilia, pederasty, underage marriage, the oppression of women, female genital mutilation, antisemitism, indiscriminate killing of Jews and Christians alike, any unbeliever. And they're here. They're here in the United States. They're here in Dearborn, Michigan. Dearbornistan, I think is what they call it now. Pretty soon there are going to be no-go zones in the United States. Now you think about that. The United States of America reducing itself to accepting the same kind of crap that Europeans are accepting now, that the Dutch accept, that the British accept and abide by, no-go zones in my country? What the hell you say? But we're very close. Hell, for all we know, they're just not saying anything about it. And I'm sure if pressed, we could probably find one or two here. Honor killings in the United States. It's a doctrine of barbarity. It's a doctrine of hate. It's a doctrine of brutality, of tyranny, of oppression, of rape, of torture, of murder, of deception, of treachery. Not dead air, I'm here. I'm just thinking about crap. So that song that Kate Smith sung, that was written especially for her by Irving Berlin, it was to serve as a rallying cry for the country. And there were voices in those days. There were voices of dissent. There were voices in America who said, well, you know, say what you want to about the Germans. Looks like they got the right idea when it comes to the Jews and the undesirables. You know what I mean? Because anti-Semitism ran rampant in Europe as well as in the United States. There were always those in positions of power and affluence and authority who looked askance at Jews. There was always, you know, in Europe it was more predominant, that anti-Semitism. It wasn't just Germans. The communists hated Jews just the way the Nazis did. But you know what? The French hated Jews and the British did too. Again, you guys, who's the moderate Muslim? Well, the moderate Muslim's the cat that's going to hold you down while the radical cuts your head off. He's the one that's going to tie you to the chair while the radical rapes and kills the women in your family. He's the one that'll hold the gas can after the radical Muslim dumps it on you and then sets you ablaze. When the radical Muslim throws the homosexual off the roof of a building, the moderate Muslims will be the ones below watching and cheering. Hamas, the Muslim Brotherhood, CARE, the Council for American Islamic Relations, Hezbollah, the Iranian Republican Guard, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, a dozen others that we don't even know of yet, Boko Haram. Every single one of them have one goal in mind, and that is placing the globe under Islamic domination. Submit or die. What are you going to do? I think we should act before we get to a place where that choice is forced upon us. I'm not calling for violence. I'm not advocating violence. I would never do that. I am not a violent man by any measure. However, that being said, if those whom I hold dear are threatened, my friends, my family, don't think I wouldn't act. Do not think I wouldn't act in the defense of my neighbors, in the defense of the people whom I know, my friends. Yeah. And there are a lot of people out there that think that way. And they don't advocate violence either. But there may be a time when violence is forced upon us. We saw it on September 11, 2001. We've seen it in 1,000 days since then. When it goes, it's going to go big. It's kind of weird. You know, this day always kind of brings me to this line of thought. Ever since that day, this day's kind of done that to me. And we can we have to be cognizant, folks. I've got a couple minutes. I'm going to knock off early tonight. I'm a little tired and sore. But we have some very serious choices confronting us on multiple levels. Very serious moral choices, very serious political choices, very serious ideological choices. And in order to make these decisions correctly, to be successful, we're going to have to be informed. What's that mean? It means a lot of things. It means we got to know stuff. You got to know your Constitution. You have to know your Bill of Rights. You have to know your Declaration of Independence. Those three documents are mission critical and turnkey to the successful operation of this country. You can't abide by those, you don't have an America. You don't know what those are, you don't have an America. How the hell are you going to defend your rights if you don't know what they're comprised of? How are you going to keep from making the same mistake the British Empire did in the 1770s if you don't know the Declaration and why we opted to separate? You got to be informed. I want to help. That's why I share some of the stuff with you that I do. Sometimes I don't do a very hot job of it, but we gotta be informed. And besides, you shouldn't take my word for any of this crap. Look it up. That way we all know. That's all the time we got. Gwendolyn here is telling me we got 60 seconds. So I'm going to say so long. We'll be back here Thursday, 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, blogtalkradio.com. What you do is go to blogtalkradio.com, and then you type in Patriot Nation Radio, and that's where you'll find ACP as well. That's all the time we got. We'll be back on Tuesday taking a look at things as we do through a conservative's perspective. I'm James Bostic. God bless each and every one of you. God bless America. We'll see you then.